Lara St. John is a violinist originally from Canada. She lives in New York City, so as you might imagine, she is in the heart of this worldwide pandemic, and a lot of things have changed. One thing that she's discovered about herself, well, as she puts it, she could sit down and make something yummy and eat the whole thing in one sitting, or she could spend some time cuddling her 5-foot dinosaur. That's right, he is a real lizard, as she puts it, an iguana, and his name is Kane, and he's quite beautiful. This is New Classical Tracks from American Public Media, and Lara St. John's new recording is called The Key of A. You'll find out more about that, too. I'm Julie Amacher. Well, first of all, happy birthday. You celebrated a birthday last week?
Yeah, last week.
So was it on the 15th or the 16th? I found conflicting information.
It's actually the 15th. And on most years, I have people say to me, oh, when I think of taxes, I think of Lara. But this year, it wasn't tax day for once.
So how did you celebrate? Well, you've been sheltering in place in New York City, right?
Yeah, well, I did a little Facebook Live, a half hour show for Violin Channel on that day, so that was fun. And basically, I don't know, had a big Zoom meeting, kind of like this, but with 20 friends, and we all sort of clinked glasses to the computer screen, and and you know, this is a way to have a party these days, I guess.
So you're really in the thick of this pandemic in New York City, and I'm wondering, what have you learned about yourself so far during the pandemic?
Well, I've learned that it is actually very easy for me to curl up in a little ball, watch Netflix all day, and go, oh, nothing matters anymore. I think we've all had days like that at this point, and so what I'm trying to do now, I'm trying to just sort of get myself to accomplish one thing a day and to just try to stay positive no matter how I need to do that. Like if it takes cuddling a giant lizard for half an hour, you know, like whatever it takes to stay positive. And also I'm very, very grateful. I'm not immune to the fact that I'm in a much better position than, for example, a lot of my colleagues. And a lot of people in this world, obviously. So I am grateful for that and think about that every day.
Since you mentioned that, I actually was going to ask you about that at the end of this interview. I mean, how are you seeing your future as a musician at this point? I mean, is something becoming clear for you or is it still very fuzzy?
Well, I don't think anything is ever going to make up for live performance. And this pandemic has eaten away at that more than just about anything else. I mean, that's what it is we do. That's what it is we live to do, is to play music and inspire people in a small space, which is the problem here. And obviously, that's not going to be possible for quite some time. The word indefinitely is really, really scary. But I really hope, and I have to keep thinking this way, that when we finally can be live again, people are just going to flock to concert halls and need that music again so much. I hope so. I mean, I can't think any other way, or else I might despair.
Are you finding this opportunity is giving you kind of a little more creative license to think about what you want to do next, maybe works you want to work on or record or collaborations you might want to do at some point?
Definitely works that I've wanted to. I have two concerto commissions, actually, that I have not yet learned, even though they're both written and they're done. One by Matthew Heinzen, an Australian composer, and one by Martin Kennedy. And one thing I do know about myself is that without deadlines and concerts and goals, I am an intrinsically lazy person. So I have had to learn to give myself these goals to really make myself do something by a certain time. And so that's one of my things this month, is to at least start learning these concertos over the next few months so that when they're needed, when people want to hear something new again, I'll have them intrinsically within. Otherwise, I've definitely been cooking a lot more. And actually, the other day, I took to 15 different people. I made Canadian pea soup because it's very comforting. And took it to a whole bunch of musician friends. And also, just to be fair, for this first month, it has been actually kind of, this is the first time I've ever been home for a month, I think, like ever. And it's been kind of weird, but kind of almost nice in a way to have a routine for the first time in my life. I can see that that's probably going to get old before this is over, but you know, again, I'm trying to be grateful for what there is to be happy about.
Tell me about the 7 o'clock cheer. You're right in the heart of New York City, and I know that that's been something that has really been boosting people there. Tell us what that experience is like.
Oh, it's really fun, actually. I have a little terrace, so I go out and bang a pot. And it seems to get louder every day, actually. Everybody sort of honks, and it only lasts 1 minute. And it's at 7 o'clock, so I don't think anyone's bothering anybody. And, you know, nice little things like WQXR puts on Ode to Joy, or, you know, and I have heard from friends of friends who are health workers and frontline workers that it really does help them get through the night shift and feel appreciated. So I think that's going to stick around for a while.
Well, you've been making some new videos, and at least one that I saw includes your pet iguana, who appears to be a fan of Beethoven.
He does like Beethoven and Bartok. Not partial to Brahms, interestingly. We're gonna try the symphonies next and see about reptile music appreciation when it comes to bigger pieces. Oh, the things you do in quarantine.
What is his name? And tell me how you got him to be so in sync with that finale to the Kreutzer Sonata that appears on your new recording.
Oh, you saw the Ludwig von Beethoven. Well, I'm also a video editor, so I do that myself. And he's very cute. His name is Kane, but he thinks his name is Baby, because I've had him since he was just a little sprite. He is now 11 years old and 5 feet long.
Is he there with you?
He's in another room. I could go grab him at the end of this if you want.
That might be fun.
Yeah, sure. He's a very sweet iguana. And we've also been doing Iggy musical appreciation courses because, you know, it's just what you do in quarantine when you live with a giant lizard.
The name of your own record label, which you started back in 1999, I think, was actually named for one of your earlier pets. Can you tell us a little bit about that pet and the name of your label?
Well, that was also an iguana. His name was Ancalagon, and I named him after a dragon from Tolkien's The Silmarillion, because I thought it would make him grow, like, big and strong or whatever. But back then, that was... he died just before I started the label in 99, and that was kind of before the internet, and we just didn't know how... I didn't know reptile husbandry as well as I do now. And so, unfortunately, he died when he was just five and a half years old. And that's how my label became named after an iguana who was named after a dragon.
Well, it's always a good conversation piece. Your new recording is called The Key of A. Tell me about that. How did you come up with The Key of A to be the theme for this? I mean, obviously the two pieces are in A major, but is there more to it than that?
A little bit. I have synesthesia. So for me, keys have very specific colors, and they always have since I was a kid. And for me, A is red. And also just the album artwork, for example, because it was written for two violinists, so two violin bows, and the cross of the A is a Damascus dagger, which is from just sort of a little mention to the Kreutzer Sonata novella, which was inspired by the Kreutzer Sonata piece. Tolstoy wrote a small novel about, well, basically, spoiler alert, the horrors of a bad marriage. So the Damascus dagger comes in at the end. And and the Frog Sonata was written as a wedding present. So there's lots of little things that tie these two together. And in fact, from violinist to violinist throughout generations, a student of somebody was the teacher of Isaac. Like they actually do have a straight line connection.
The Kreutzer Sonata opens in a very challenging way, and it's actually something that prevents some violinists from even wanting to take it on. What is it for you when you approach this work? How does that opening section, how does that resonate with you? How do you approach it?
Well, it is always a little, just to sort of stand up, the Kreutzer is so long that you don't put something before it in half of a program. So basically there you are, the violinist, there's a huge piano behind you, and you start all by yourself with these really awkward chords, actually. Thanks, keyboard player Beethoven. Just all alone, and then the piano answers.
The violin opens in a major key, and then the piano reinvents that in a minor key, and then there are three repeated notes, and then a resolution a half step down. And then Beethoven kind of plays with that idea and whittles it down to like, what, two notes, the E and F, that seem to not have any relation, but clearly they do. Can you talk a little bit about that?
I think it's a sort of a genius way of keeping people on the edge. What he does in that opening, you know that nothing's started yet, and it's like the calm before the storm. I mean, for me, even I can usually, while I'm waiting for this stuff, like I can hear my heart beating. You know, it's like, so it's actually almost fear inducing how he did that, because you know something's coming, but you don't know what. I don't think anybody ever started a sonata like that before that, or even have since. It's definitely a little butterfly inducing in the heart. I mean, he obviously wrote this for his good friend George Bridgetower, who actually was the original dedicatee. And then there's, it depends who you talk to or what historical book you look at, but it has something to do with a woman, and Bridgetower somehow offended Beethoven by saying something mean about a friend of his or something. So then, of course, Beethoven got all upset and rescinded the dedication, and then thought, hey, why don't I dedicate it to this famous violinist named Rudolf Kreutzer, because then maybe he'll play it and it'll be awesome. And Kreutzer hated it. And he never...
Well, he didn't even tell Kreutzer about it, did he, when he decided to make that dedication?
I think he did. I mean, it was well known that Kreutzer hated the sonata. He never played it. He didn't. He said, absolutely no way am I playing this. And for some strange reason, that's the name that stuck. It's like really kind of ironic. It should be the Bridgetower Sonata, really. But in any case, just the imagining like Beethoven and Bridgetower, this, just the thought of these two playing this piece, it's just so, so amazing. And actually, Liszt took it up about 50 years later and played it a lot with violinist friends of his. That must have been incredible. Ah, to be a fly on the wall.
What do you love the most about this sonata? Because this is something that you learned a little later in your career, right?
Yeah, and it was not taught to me, if you will. I taught it to myself, basically, and I didn't have any preconceptions whatsoever. And when Matt and I started playing together, I thought, oh, okay, this is somebody with whom I want to do the Kreutzer eventually. And we just kind of agreed on, for example, tempi. And in the time of Beethoven, even Liszt, for example, variation movement, there's no way that Beethoven himself, that he wouldn't have done variations on his variations. You know, I guess now the tradition is to just play them exactly the same way twice. And we didn't want to do that. That's not how it would have been then live. And so we sort of went back to that somewhat lost tradition of improvising the second time around. And of course, I mean, Matt's a great jazz pianist as well. So for him to just sort of figure out what to do with variations was like second nature.
Yeah, very cool. I bet you've learned a lot from him.
Oh, yeah, very much so. Yeah.
Can you think of like one thing that maybe you've been able to apply to this particular recording?
Well, I think just the ease with which he just comes up with stuff and imagines things, I think that that translates a little bit into flow, if you will, for classical music. Like, I mean, he could just sort of sit down and play for an hour, and it can just come out of his head. And I think that that, for example, the first movement of the Franck. Sounds as though, like, we're making it up, you know, because it flows towards a certain place, and then and so that kind of spontaneity in playing is something that he has that I have not encountered so much in other pianists.
How is it that the two of you are so well matched? I know you've done a number of recordings together, and this one in particular is pretty challenging, actually even for the pianist as well as for you, in terms of the parts that were written.
Oh, maybe even more so. I mean, both sonatas were written for violinists by, well, pianist keyboard players. In the case of Franck, he was an organist. And I think the parts are incredibly equal. It's certainly not a violin and piano sonata. So it's actually, Beethoven even wrote sonatas for piano and violin. And the Kreutzer, for example, the Beethoven 9, it's a very extreme piece, extreme tempos, extreme dynamics. Extreme people. So it was a great pairing, I think, for this particular CD.
I think I read that the Kreutzer Sonata and the Franck Sonata are often paired together. Why is that?
The reason I paired them together, that's what I can talk about, is because they're arguably the sort of the pinnacle of their respective eras. The Kreutzer being classical and Franck being romantic. I mean, for violin and piano, they're both in A, as we discussed, and for me that's a very cardinal, very red key, and they're both written by pianists for violins. I mean, there's a lot, they have a lot in common. They're the equal of each other from two different eras.
The Franck Sonata was a wedding gift for an incredible virtuoso, Eugenie Sai, and he actually did play it on his wedding day, but he played it like sort of as a pre-wedding piece. Is that right?
Yeah, I think he played it the morning of his wedding. From what I understand, is kind of an offertorium, like people were walking in and here he is playing his wedding present. He eventually, in public, did the premiere, I think a few weeks later.
And he really liked it.
Well, yeah, I mean, what a piece. It really is. It really is something.
And this is one of those pieces where the piano part might even be more challenging than the violin part. Can you talk a little bit about that and maybe how Matt approaches that?
I think they both are, actually. I think both the Kreutzer, the Beethoven 9 and the Franck are, I wouldn't say piano heavy because they're also very violin heavy, but so equal as to, if anybody called Matt an accompanist for this, I'd be like, are you kidding me? Yeah, I mean, well, Matt's a very extreme player and, you know, I don't want to say loud, although he is very loud, but very powerful player. And I think that's you really need something that you can't be a wimp for this second movement of the Franck.
Thank you.
and of course not for the Kreutzer. The extremes really do come through with him. And I mean, he's got technique to burn, so that part's not... I mean, I don't think anything's hard for that guy. We tend to agree on stuff. Like, we try everything, you know? I mean, I've tried the second movement of the Franck at double tempo, at half tempo. At, you know, let's just see what works. Does this feel right, you know? And somehow, I mean, I think that's what a really great collaboration is, when you both feel right at the same time and it couldn't go any other way.
It's a new recording called The Key of A, featuring violinist Lara St. John. Thanks to Valerie Kaler for producing this episode of New Classical Tracks. If you're enjoying this podcast, the best thing that you can do for the show is to tell somebody else about it, help spread the word, and take a moment to rate and review us on your podcasting app. That's New Classical Tracks from American Public Media. I'm Julia Mocker.